You are listening to the Fresh Take Network.
Well, welcome to Fresh Take. Joshua Adam William Arbuthnot alongside Richard Strobant, and it's an honor to have a Hall of Fame broadcaster today with Daryl Janz on the show. Welcome so much, Daryl.
Hey, good to be here. Richard and I go back a long way, and very nice to link up with you on this, Josh.
Absolutely.
Yeah, our relationship started way back when I first started at SAIT. You were my broadcast news instructor, and I mentioned this once to you when you and I worked at CFCN upstairs and CJ92 downstairs. You were the one that interviewed me to get into the program, Daryl. Way back when I was just a 17-year-old little kid out of high school, and convinced you somehow, some way, that this was what I was meant to do. And you must have saw something, because now, however many years later, after a career at CJ92, I just finished doing my 15th year of teaching at SAIT. Like I said, a program that you taught at, and you also taught at Mount Royal. So.
Yes, you have now taught longer at SAIT than I did, but you've taught the number of, I taught 16 years at Mount Royal and 11 at SAIT, so a total of 26 years.
I got a ways to go yet.
Well, and it was my training. Out of high school in Herbert, Saskatchewan, I went to Regina Saskatchewan Teachers College and to be a teacher, and taught for 1 year in a rural one-room schoolhouse near Craven, Saskatchewan, on the edge of the Capel Valley. Craven is in the valley. We were up top in rural Route 1 Craven. Yeah, anybody that lived west of where we were was bused to Craven. But from all around us, from the farms all around us, the kids came, and I didn't have a large group. I had, I think, only about 10 students, maybe 11 grades 1-7.
Wow.
It was my life that 1 year. I don't know if you ever saw the movie Why Shoot the Teacher. It was filmed in Saskatchewan. The book Why Shoot the Teacher was written by a former teacher. In fact, his story was a lot like mine, the book was turned into a movie, a Hollywood movie, and it was very, very good, very funny. Great memories. And it was while I was in teachers college that I really began to grow interested in broadcasting. And two high school teachers had kicked up that interest in broadcasting in me.
Wow.
One who was my coach and saw how inept I was at sports, but suggested I become a sportscaster because I knew so much about sports. I could probably quote you the stats of almost every player in the old six-team NHL. Wow. I was a Toronto Maple Leafs fan, for which I have done penance many times. And became a Montreal Canadiens fan when I worked in Montreal. But anyway,
that's right.
So he suggested sportscasting. My social studies teacher suggested journalism. And so I kind of blended the two. I took the broadcasting aspect of what the coach was suggesting. My social studies teacher meant a print journalist, because that was a real journalist back then.
Yeah, right.
It was a good blend, and it's been an incredible ride for 59 years this July 1st.
Wow. Okay, so I got a long way to go to catch up with you.
You got a long way to go.
You know what? It started, like you said, it started way back. Your first station was London, Ontario. No, you worked
let's go way farther back. Started in radio.
Yeah.
Started in radio on July 1st, Dominion Day, 1962, at CFM in Altona, Manitoba, the mothership of what today is a large company called Golden West Broadcasting.
That's right. Yeah.
But they were a one station company at that time in Altona, Manitoba.
Was Elmer Hildebrand there at the time?
Elmer was the sales manager. He was only, you know, about 5 years older than me. Yeah. And he was the sales manager. And he and I hit it off very well. Some of the on-air guys didn't like the salespeople because they thought they were the dark side of the business. But I always realized that without salespeople, I wouldn't get a paycheck. Yep. And so I got along very well with Elmer. And then after I'd left and gone for a very brief stint, spinning country music at CJGX Radio in Yorkton, Saskatchewan. I was from Saskatchewan, had grown up near Swift Current on a combined grain farm cattle ranch. And so coming back to Saskatchewan, to Yorkton for just that summer of 63. And as I said, country music. And two songs stick out in my mind from that summer. There were a lot of great country hits that year, but the two that stick in my mind are Johnny Cash's Ring of Fire and Porter Wagoner's I've Enjoyed As Much of This As I Can Stand.
Too funny. So moving through the radio business, then your first TV station was in London, wasn't it?
No, my first TV station, get this, Moose Jaw had the first CTV license in Saskatchewan.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Back then, any station in a city, if there was only one station, had to be CBC. That was the law. Mm-hmm. And so Regina and Saskatoon both had CFTC in Saskatoon and CKCK Regina. Mm-hmm. We're both CBC affiliates. And because Moose Jaw is so close to Regina, the CRTC, no, it wasn't the CRTC yet, but it became that. It was the Canadian Broadcasting Commission at that time. Mm-hmm. And they allowed Moose Jaw, the Moffat family, a license for the first CTV station in Saskatchewan. And wow. So that's where I went. I was hired there by Ken Newens. Who is a very familiar name in this market.
Indeed.
He was then the program manager of CHAB Radio and Television in Moose Jaw. And he hired me in the fall of 63. The rest, as they could say, is history.
Wow.
So then from there, I went to CFQC in Saskatoon, which is today CTV Saskatoon.
Right.
And worked there for three. It was the first time I became the solo 6 o'clock anchor. In Moose Jaw, we had our little Huntley and Brinkley pair of Wally Mott and I. Wally went on to CTV National News, mm-hmm. and became the backup to Harvey Kirk.
That's
before
right.
Lloyd Robertson left CBC and joined us. Mm-hmm. So Wally and I did the 6 o'clock news in Moose Jaw, and I would do the late alone. But in Saskatoon, I became the solo 6 o'clock anchor. And then in the fall of 68, I got my big break. My big break. I got called. I hadn't even applied because I didn't think I was ready for them. I got called by CFCF in Montreal.
That's right.
And joined Canada's first radio station, CFCF Radio, and Quebec's only CTV station, CFCF Television. That was an incredible time to be in Quebec. Expo had just finished. The Expos arrived just then, were the first major league team, of course, in Canada, long with 8 years, 8 seasons before the Blue Jays started,
right.
were the Montreal Expos. And that was fun baseball. Little Jarry Park was such a great place to go for a baseball game. And the French Canadians knew a fair bit about baseball, but they didn't know the lingo of baseball. And so you'd hear some interesting calls from the stands calling the umpire ref and stuff like that.
Yeah. Wow. Now, I remember hearing this story when I was in your class at SAIT about flying the helicopter in Montreal. You did that a little bit too.
I they didn't allow me to fly it. I was able to fly it, but I didn't have a license. Mm-hmm. But anyway, on the day the Expos played their home opener on April 14th, 1969, we could have had a snowstorm, but we had Drapeau weather. Jean Drapeau had a run of luck on important days, like the opening of Expo in 1967 and opening day of the Expos in 1969. We had what we call Drapeau weather, and it was close to a hot day, and we were up in the chopper covering traffic going to this historic occasion at Jarry Park, and suddenly a call came from the police chopper. They needed help because some guys had gone fishing in the St. Lawrence where there were still big ice floes, and they got tipped out of their boat and into the icy St. Lawrence. And so the police were asking for help. And so we went, and I had an inexperienced pilot because my regular pilot had been seconded by Hydro Quebec to go on Hydro Line patrol that day. Mm-hmm. And as we were trying to get down to lower level to rescue this one guy, my inexperienced pilot got us into the drink and totaled the chopper. But both of us were rescued brought out safely, and were actually near the Expo site when we came up. Going back while we were in the water, climbing up onto the pontoons to wonder what would come next, along came the Hydro-Quebec chopper with my regular veteran pilot in it. And he rescued us, wow, took us to shore, and then went and rescued the guy we'd been trying to rescue. Mm-hmm. And so it could have turned out worse, but it did turn out quite badly because one of the guys in the water drowned.
Oh.
And so that was the sad part of it. Mm-hmm. But interestingly enough, 3.5 years later, when I was leaving Montreal, get this, I was in the biggest city in Canada at that time, still at that time, yep, bigger than Toronto.
Yep, that's right.
And since then, Toronto has passed it by a lot. But at that time, Montreal was still number one. And from there, I went to see FPL in London. And that's another story that we might get to. But anyway, my time in Montreal involved the FLQ crisis of 1970,
wow,
the October crisis, when the Front de Libération du Québec, the Quebec Liberation Front, a terrorist organization, kidnapped British Trade Commissioner James Cross.
That's
and
right.
Held him for 2 months, and kidnapped and murdered Quebec Labor Minister Pierre Laporte.
That's right.
And it was that's when Pierre Trudeau invoked the War Measures Act. He was a decisive man, like him or hate him, and it was one or the other. Hardly anybody was cool or warm on Trudeau. They were either hot or cold. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he was a very decisive man, and he invoked the War Measures Act, which meant they could arrest people and hold them for quite a while without charging them. Mm-hmm. Just hold them on suspicion. And many of those that were arrested were never charged. Some were, but so that was one of the very noteworthy things that I covered there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was there, I went there to work for radio, for CFCF radio. And the summer after I got there, the summer of 69, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of radio. I'm not sure why radio didn't do anything in 2019, because that was the 100th anniversary of radio. And it started in Canada. The first radio station in the world was CFCF in Montreal, although it didn't have those call letters then. But it was put on the air in the fall of 1919 by Guglielmo Marconi. He had come to Montreal from Newfoundland, where he did most of his radio experimentation. Mm-hmm. And had come to Montreal and put the first station in the world on the air. And that was in my first full year there. But shortly after I got there, the 6 o'clock anchor quit to head back west. It was a guy from Edmonton. And when he quit, they auditioned people inside as well as took applications from outside for that 6 o'clock job. And Burke Cannings, the news director, called me into his office and said, "You'd have got the job if you didn't look so young." So I missed out on a job because I looked too young, and I was only 27. And so they hired this veteran from Vancouver, Andrew Marquis, and made him the 6 o'clock. But Cannings said, you know, he gave me the bronze medal. Well, no, the silver medal wasn't the bronze. Made me the backup. Mm-hmm. And so I had not gone there to work in television. But within 6 months of getting there, I was on television every weekend and filling in whenever the full-time guy went on vacation or wasn't there for any reason.
Mm-hmm. So the move to come to Calgary, a difficult decision? Was it easy for you?
Well, I was doing very well down east. My name was getting to be well known. And I thought, if I go back west, they'll forget about me. And I checked my head now, but for the same reason I cheered for the Toronto Maple Leafs, I wanted to work in Toronto. Mm. And then finally, CFCN made it worth my while to come back. And again, Ken Newlands had a big hand in that. He was sports director then.
That's right.
And when Peter Kent left CFCN to go to CBC Ottawa, mm-hmm. they contacted me from CFCN and said, "Would you like to come back west?" And I wasn't sure, but finally they convinced me, and I came and signed a 5-year contract in 1973. In November 73, I signed a 5-year contract and said, "And that's it. After that, I'm heading back east." Well, that was 47 years ago, year 48. And I'm still not sure I'm going back east. No, this became home. Yeah. This was a booming city. And then in 1981, they hooked me for life, because I got sent to Baden-Baden, Germany for the IOC Congress at mm-hmm. which Calgary was bidding for the 1988 Winter Olympics. And once those Olympics had been granted to Calgary, I knew I couldn't leave here until after 1988. There was right. no leaving until after those Olympics. In the meantime, I became so enmeshed in Calgary and Calgary in me that mm-hmm. I knew there was no leaving, that this was where I was for the rest of my career, which continues. I'm so grateful for that. I anchored for 40 years, 37 the 6 o'clock on five nights a week, and then for a few more years on weekends.
Right.
And started doing this Inspired Albertan feature that has become one of the favorite things I've ever done. It's so much fun. And I can't wait to when I can get out again and do the interviews myself.
I bet.
Kevin Green's doing a great job of doing the interviews for me. In fact, he's doing one right now on location. But soon, I've been double vaccinated now. And soon, I will be able to go out again and do the thing I love most, and that's meeting the people and interviewing them.
I remember as a kid running into you at the Calgary Co-op in Richmond. I don't even know what year it was, but I remember running into you and I went, man, like I grew up and with so many other people listening to this podcast, the same thing. They grew up watching you and to run into a celebrity, and you always have been, and you still are, and you always were then, just so unbelievably down to earth. You talked to every person at this co-op who you know, said, hi, Daryl, you know, and it wasn't just a hi back. It's a hi, how you doing type of thing. It's that, you know, that small town boy from, you know, from Saskatchewan who still loves to farm. And I don't know how you find time to do all the stuff you did when, you know.
Well, not farming anymore, but for 15 years, I drove a friend's combine out northeast of High River at a place called Gladys Ridge. And I drove his combine for 15 years and loved it. And, yeah. I miss it.
Yeah.
Comes a time when climbing up those ladders and the combines kept getting higher and higher and the ladders kept getting longer and longer. But I loved it. And continue to. When people complain about spring moisture, whether it be snow or rain, I say, hey, I'm a farmer. It's moisture.
I bet. Like, the thing that always surprised me, Daryl, for you is not just the combining and doing the farming and stuff like that, but I teach at SAIT now and I'm teaching full-time, but you taught almost full-time, I'm sure that it was, and then you'd teach in the morning at SAIT or at Mount Royal, and then whatever time it was, head over to CFCN, and then you'd do your full-time job on the news. How the hell did you find the time for all this stuff?
Looking back, I do a lot of sleeping now to catch up, but anyway, it's how we grew up. I mean, on the farm, you were up at 5 to milk the cows, whether it was pitch dark in December and January or bright by 4 o'clock in the morning. You just did it. You went and you milked the cows and you, fed the pigs and the chickens and all that stuff. Then you went to school, not in the clothes you'd worn while you were doing that, but in clean clothes. You went to school and did your work there and played baseball and tried to be a track and field athlete. It was okay as a mile runner, but that's the only thing. Long jump. I did fairly well at long jump. But anyway, that was life. That's how we lived. And on top of all that, I come from a Mennonite family in a Mennonite community, and Mennonites are known for their hard work. So it was my Mennonite connections that got me my job in Altona, because Altona and Steinbach are the Mennonite capitals of Western Canada.
Yep.
And so it was an hereditary thing. It was an ethnical thing, and it was a religious thing too, because hard work was getting you closer to God, and so I enjoyed all those things, and I really had the ability to work and remain alert on 6.5 hours sleep a night, and here I am, pushing 80, getting very close, and still enjoying life.
And your recollection of dates as well. I can barely remember what I had for supper last night, and you're telling me the day that the Expos first game was, but then again, having a helicopter crash that day, I guess I probably wouldn't forget that day either, I suppose.
Well, there are two or several great memories I have regarding the Expos. I loved going to the games. Jari Park was right across the railroad tracks from CFCF radio and television. And all I had to do is go over a pedestrian overpass, and I was at Jari Park. And I have great memories of going there when I was doing the early morning radio shift and finishing after the 12:30 noon news, I would go over, and the visiting team had batting practice first, and then the Expos. And so the Expos would just be wrapping up when I'd get there. And Ron Pichet, a Quebecer who had had a good major league pitching career, was one of the pitching coaches of the Expos. And every once in a while, Ron would say to me, "Hey, want to take a few swings at some pitches from me in the batting cage?" I said, "Sure." And he would throw them at me, and he wasn't being kind. He was throwing them at me. And I hit a few good ones. He said, a number of times, he said, "That would have been a homer." So I got to do, I mean, what Mennonite farm kid from Saskatchewan gets to go into the batting cage against a major league pitcher, gets to sit in the press box. My favorite press box memories are sitting next to Danny Gallivan, the greatest hockey play-by-play man at the time, who loved baseball. And Danny and I would sit in the Ajari Park press box and eat those fabulous steamer hot dogs that the American writers and broadcasters all said, those are the best hot dogs in Major League Baseball. So we would sit there, and Charles Bronfman, the owner of the Expos, would come to the press box to make sure that the media were happy, that we had plenty of hot dogs, that everything was good, that the pop, and I don't think they served beer in the press box back then, but that everything was nice and cold and to our liking. He was a great, great PR man for his own organization. But sitting next to Danny Gallivan was such a thrill.
I bet.
The last time I ever saw him in person was when he and Dick Irvin, whom I worked with for all of those 4 years in Montreal, he and Dick came to do the game between the Flames and the Oilers when they opened the Saddle Dome in the fall of 1984. That was amazing, an amazing thrill. And my daughter, who was a teenager, wanted to meet Danny Gallivan. I had told her about us sitting in the press box and so on, and she wanted to meet Danny Gallivan. So I introduced her, and Danny didn't need any refresher about me. In fact, when he saw me down the hallway, down under the, you've been under the, down where the media lounge is and the players' dressing rooms and so on. Well, Danny came along that hallway to the media room, and he saw me there, and he lit up. He said, "Daryl," he said, "I haven't seen you since we sat at the Expos game in the press box." And Dick was a delightful guy to work with. He was born in Regina when his dad was coaching the Regina Pats in the Saskatchewan Junior Hockey League, which today is the WHL. But he coached them to a Memorial Cup and some other great things. And then he got picked up by the Montreal Canadiens to coach them to, I think, 4 Stanley Cups. And Dick was named after his dad and got into broadcasting. So got to know those guys. I got to know Don Cherry. Wonderful guy. Another one my daughter wanted to meet, and we were able to arrange that. And he was just so kind and sweet to her. I mean, Don Cherry is a wonderful Canadian. And I'm not going to start editorializing here, but I have some views on what happened. Yeah. But another one she wanted to meet, in the fall of 1980, when the Flames were playing in the Corral, where they had just come from Atlanta, the Leafs came to town, and Shannon wanted to meet Harold Ballard. I mean, what 13-year-old girl wants to meet Harold Ballard? She did. And so I took her into the press box at the Corral, and there were Ballard and King Clancy sitting, looking out at warm up. The team's were warming up, and I said, excuse me, Mr. Ballard, my daughter Shannon would like to meet you. And he turns around and turns on the charm, and he could be charming. A crusty old Leafs owner says, Shannon, nice to meet you, honey. He said, let's chat. He said, King, give her your chair. So this legend of a hockey King Clancy gets up, and this teenager sits down in his chair, and King and I start chatting, but I'm kind of overhearing what's going on between Shannon and Harold Ballard. And she noticed his tie. He was wearing a dark navy tie with a solitary pig in the middle. And she giggles like a 13-year-old girl and says, nice tie. And picks up the tie with his thumb and says, honey, I'm proud of this tie. He says, this women's group in Toronto named me Male Chauvinist Pig of the Year and gave me this tie for something I had said to, now her name slips on my mind, the former governor general. They had the CBC show.
Yeah.
Adrian Clarkson.
That's right.
Adrian Clarkson. He said, they gave me this tie for something I said to Adrian Clarkson on her CBC show. Shannon is a 55-year-old woman now, but she remembers all that stuff so fondly.
Too funny. Josh, go ahead. I'm sure you've got a billion questions.
Yeah, again, Peter, thanks for having I was so interested, obviously, with the Expo stuff and, you know, how they left and everything, but they struggle a little bit, but then they bring in this kid, Gary Carter, in 74, and then he becomes maybe the greatest Expo of all time. What was the atmosphere like as Gary kind of progressed, and he becomes an all-star in 75 and then has a long string of all-stars with the Expos?
Well, by then I was in Calgary, but following the Expos extremely closely and had a lot of friends there. And they said he ignited that stadium like nobody ever had. I mean, in the early days, we had Rusty Staub, great, great ball player. Mm-hmm. We had Ron Fairley, who was near the end of his career, but an all-star first baseman. We had Mac Jones. In
I was going to say Mac Jones, yeah.
It became Jonesville. Yeah. We had a great catcher named John Bateman, who had caught for a number of major league teams, including Houston. And then we had a great utility player. And sometimes my favorite participant at the park was PA announcer Claude Mouton. Claude was the Canadiens PA announcer, and the Expos asked him, Do you know baseball? Do you want to do our PA? I said, oh, yeah. And so he was the first bilingual PA announcer in Major League Baseball. In fact, until Claude came along, PA announcers in baseball were very boring. Now at bat, the left fielder, whoever. And Claude would change things. We had a utility player named John Bacabella. He would play catcher sometimes, shortstop sometimes. He was good at all of them. Anyway, when he was playing, Claude would say, maintenant baton, now at bat, le lanceur, the catcher, John Bacabella. And he'd give it that beautiful Italian ring. And it was just so much fun being at that park. My children's mother didn't ever go to a Canadiens game with me. She didn't care for hockey except for the little town where she grew up in Saskatchewan because the goalie was her boyfriend. But anyway, that was before I came along. But anyway, she loved going to baseball games. And I'll never forget, we were sitting near first base, and Ron Fairley had this big thing stuffed in his cheek. And I said, boy, look at the wad of tobacco in Fairley's cheek. And she says, I'll bet you it's bubble gum. So we made a bet. And there's a lull in the play, and we're both looking at Fairley, and he blows this big pink bubble. He says, told you.
Too funny.
Oh, yeah. Montreal was so much fun. It was just a year after Expo, and the Expo Islands were busy, busy, busy with tourists coming and locals going. They had a great fun park along the lines of Callaway Park here, but bigger. Mm-hmm. And so that became a very popular place. And we loved family trips to Quebec City. And when we went to Quebec City, we would always go to one of the great crepe houses in old town Quebec City. They were like being in something right in France. Wow. And so many great memories of that time in Quebec. It was only 4 years, and yet sometimes it seems almost like the peak of my career. And don't get me wrong, I have loved my years in Calgary. In fact, I wouldn't trade them for anything. But Quebec, we were so close to so many things, to the Laurentians in the fall when the leaves turned red on those maple trees. We would go, and the Mont Saint-Agathe ski hill would have its main chair running so people could go up to the top to take video, well, not video, film. I had a Super 8 film camera and shot some great stuff of the colors of the Laurentians and so much other stuff. Sugaring season in March and early April, when the sap was running in the maples, and they had these little, what they call cabana souk, sugar cabins, where they became restaurants for that short time. The rest of the time, they sat boarded up and empty. But in the spring, during sugaring time, they became restaurants where you got a great, genuine French-Canadian meal, and everything was soaked in hot maple syrup. Or you did that yourself. You didn't have to, but they'd bring you a big pitcher of hot maple syrup from a big vat in the middle of the room where the maple syrup was slowly bubbling. Wow. And it was so tasty. And then outside on the snow, they would lay down strips of hot maple syrup that would very quickly cool into kind of a toffee. And the kids were given a stick, like a rebel stick, and we're allowed to roll this stuff up on the stick and suck on it.
Wow. Josh, you got another question? Go ahead.
Oh, man. I could go on for days. So you were involved in the 81 bid for the Olympics, and we get in 88. What was kind of the process of getting the bid, and then ultimately, obviously, so many highlights in that game, and Eddie the Eagle, and the Jamaican bobsled team, and so many more. But what was the process of getting the bid to getting the Olympics, and some of your favorite Olympic stories?
Oh wow! Well, I'm writing my autobiography. So from the
excellent
time, from the time Frank King came on our show live with Ken Newlands to announce that they had set up a committee to bid for the 1988 Winter Olympics. And this would have been in about 1978 or so. Ken Newlands got him on live. But from then until after the 88 Olympics are done, so far, take up four chapters in my book.
Oh my gosh.
And there's just so much there. But so I started to get excited when Frank talked that day. He was still an executive at an oil company at the time. In fact, I think he was the CEO, and he stayed at that until we had the bid won, and then he became the full-time president of the organizing committee. But going back to the bid, it was about, oh, I guess around June, maybe May, around this time of year, Thompson McDonald, who was then our director of news and public affairs, in fact, he was vice president of news and public affairs at CFCN. Thompson called me into his office and he said, they're going for the bid this coming September and we need to be there and we need our big guy to be there. So he said, I'm sending you to Baden-Baden, Germany in September for the IOC Congress. It's going to decide who gets the 88 Olympics. And boy, talk about a thrill.
I bet. And
so then I did not take a shooter with me from Calgary. I joined up in Baden-Baden with the CTV London crew. The reporter was Clark Todd, who in 1984 was killed in the Shouf Mountains in Lebanon during the civil war over there. But anyway, back then, Clark was London bureau chief, and his shooter was a guy named Brian, can't remember Brian's last name, but anyway, they came and joined me in Baden-Baden, and we covered for the next week the IOC, or 5 days, the IOC Congress, and then, of course, ending with the big vote reveal. And I'll never forget Clark and Johnny Esau, who was president of CTV Sports at that time, said to me, Frank knows you, he trusts you, you go and stand right near him when Samaranch is ready to make the reveal, and you get him first. They said, I know CBC wants him first, but we're going to get him first. And so I went and stood there, and Brian, the shooter, came with me. And so as soon as Samaranch, in his dramatic flair, said, les jeux de whatever, and then he comes to La Ville de Calgary, and Frank rocketed out of his chair like he had been, like he was on a powerful Tesla rocket. And when he landed and had finished all the congratulations with George Kingston and Peter Lougheed and Ralph Klein and all the rest of that group, he then turned to me and we got him first. And I was so close to him that if to this day you see on Global some of the video that Gary Bobrovitz and Rick Copley shot, I'm in the picture because I was so close to Frank they couldn't get any video without me in it. And of course, you know how competitive the business
absolutely
was back then, still is, but it was so competitive then. And so we got that. I went to the outskirts, or to the river. The Rhine runs through that area, and I went and did my stand up in the Black Forest that night for the 6 o'clock news, and then we went to the hotel where the whole Calgary committee was staying and partied long into the night.
That. And you speak, you do speak some German, and did back then, didn't you?
Back then, it was better than it is now. I grew up, it was the first language I spoke as a child.
Right.
And all the church services at the Mennonite Church were in German. And we learned German in school. We were able to learn German instead of French. Mm-hmm. I wish I'd taken French too, or could have been able to. I couldn't. So yeah. Anyway, yeah. So, and I brushed up on my German before going over. And by the time I went, it was good enough that I was able to converse with hotel clerks and so on. And the problem was, I would approach them and say, Guten Tag, Ich heiße Daryl Jans. Ich komme aus Kanada. Und ich habe eine Vorbestellung, which is what you make it at a hotel when you're going to stay there, a reservation.
Yeah.
I have a reservation. Well, I would do this, and they would immediately start talking in full speed German to me. And I would say, langsam bitte, langsam. Ich bin Kanadisch. And they'd say, oh, but like, langsam bitte, it means slow, oh, please. Yeah. I'm Canadian. And they'd say, but you have no accent in your German. I said, well, it's the first language I learned as a child. And so I know proper pronunciation, even if my German isn't up to snuff anymore. But it got better and better as we were there.
I bet.
By the time Ken Newens came to join us, I picked him up at the Frankfurt airport. And on our way back to Baden-Baden, he said, have you eaten breakfast? I said, no, I didn't want to get up that early. And he said, I said, didn't you eat on the plane? He said, no, I slept through breakfast. And he said, I said, oh, these gas stations have fabulous diners in them. I said, so we'll stop at one of them and have breakfast. So we walked in, and the lady who greeted us took our order, and I did the whole thing in German. And we even had a little chat, she and I. And when she went off to the kitchen to put in our order, Nguyen's looks across the table at me in amazement and says, you son of a bitch, I had no idea you were so fluent. I said, I didn't either.
Oh, that's too funny. Fantastic. Go ahead, Josh.
I'm interested, just, you know, the city has evolved so much. How have you watched the city, and what's the biggest thing you've seen the city evolve from when you got there to now?
Well, when I got here, the population was 420,000. The Calgary Tower was by far the tallest thing on the skyline, and the Palliser was the tallest building. That and another building on, forget what avenue it is, it's still there, but is now lost in all the high rises. It was still basically cowtown. And of course, having grown up in the ranching community and having grown up with rodeo, I never participated. My uncle won roping at the Stampede in 1938. My dad was a pretty good bronc rider, but never rode professionally. He only participated in amateur rodeos and so on. But anyway, so that part I was familiar with. I was not familiar with the oil industry. And so the man who familiarized me with the oil industry and was a wonderful mentor is Jim Gray, who is still a big name around town. And sadly, I understand they're closing the YMCA named after him down in Eau Claire. But anyway, he taught me about the oil industry, and I got to know all these things. And then there was this battle going on between Pierre Trudeau and Peter Lougheed. The two Peters were at each other's necks about who owns these resources. And Lougheed stood up for Alberta like nobody ever did. And there was a real fight going on. And Thompson MacDonald arranged for Donald MacDonald, Thumper MacDonald, from Pierre Trudeau's energy minister, to come and do kind of a debate in our studio with Don Getty, the Alberta energy minister. And so we were, I was moderating it. Thanks to Jim Gray, I now had enough knowledge about the oil industry that I could do it knowledgeably. And so I was moderating that, and we had some other media people from the city on a panel. And the one guy from the Albertan, which became the Sun, the one guy from the Albertan asked a question that made MacDonald furious. And he got up, pulled off his lapel mic and threw it at me and said, I don't have to take this shit. And he stormed out of the studio, and this made CTV national news. It also made CBC's The National. They asked CTV in Toronto, can we have that video of McDonald throwing the mic at the host and stomping out of there? And so he ran not only on CTV, but on CBC as well.
Wow.
It created quite a kerfuffle, and in the long run kind of worked in Alberta's favor, because people across the country saw it and said, that's not right. That's not how a federal government treats a provincial government. And it kind of worked in Alberta's favor. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's funny. I had never forgotten that incident, but I didn't dwell on it. Years later, when Don Getty announced he was running for the leadership of the Alberta Progressive Conservative Party, when Peter announced his retirement, I went to the event at the Palliser at which Don Getty made his announcement. And I went up and introduced him. I said, Mr. Getty, I'm Daryl Jans from CGV. He said, Daryl, you don't have to introduce yourself to me. He said, remember that night Don McDonald threw his mic at you and said, I don't have to take this shit. And that refreshed it in my mind, and it became part of my lore. One of the stories I tell, and it was fun. I, you know, when you get to my age and are still working and loving it, and you look back and you say, how could this have happened to a kid from a farm in a little Mennonite community whose only real claim to fame, I found later, not then, but now, or in recent years, is that Maine Center is also the birthplace of Homer Simpson. Have you guys heard that story?
No.
I have, yeah.
I'm from a Mennonite community called Maine Center, Saskatchewan. And in 1919, or sorry, let's go back, a family named Gruning homesteaded there, just like the Janses or the Yants, as we were called, mm-hmm. and many, many others. But Homer Gruning was born on the homestead, not far from our land, in 1919. In 1936, when he was 17, his dad was invited to come to Hillsboro, Kansas, to be a professor of theology at Tabor College. Get this, Homer Simpson is the son of a theologian, of a Bible teacher. And
wow.
Matt told this story, the founder of the Simpsons, told this story at the Comedy Festival in Montreal a number of years back. A reporter had asked him, Homer, does Homer have ties to Canada? And Matt said, oh yeah, he was born in Canada. He was born in Saskatchewan. Well, to a Montreal reporter, that's enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Regina Peter Post got a hold of it, and they dug out the full story and published it. And so now we can proudly say we come from the home of Homer Simpson.
Oh,
that's
wow.
Amazing.
There's so many questions I still have. You touched on one that I usually save for the end, but when I talk to the legends that we've talked to, the question that always comes up, again, a farm boy from, you know, small town Saskatchewan, like the dreams that you had when you were starting into broadcasting and hoping where you'd be. Like at a certain point in time, life surpassed that dream, right? You know, what was that like for you, where it's like, well, geez, you know, I was hoping to get here, but now I'm here and I'm on every bus bench and billboard and LRT sign. And I mean, you couldn't throw a dead cat without hitting the Daryl Jans poster in this city, you know? Like, what is that like for you?
Well, remember in the movie Broadcast News, Albert Brooks saying to William Hurt, what do you do? No, William Hurt saying to Albert Brooks, it was the other way around, William Hurt saying to Albert Brooks, what do you do when your real life exceeds your wildest dreams? And Albert Brooks says, you keep it to yourself.
Good point.
But no, my dream was simply to be on air. I wanted to be on CKCK in Regina, and never even did work there. The two TV stations I worked at in Saskatchewan were Moose Jaw, CHAB, and CFQC Saskatoon. And I just did not have big dreams. I thought those were big dreams. When I got to dreaming a little bigger, I thought, well, maybe Winnipeg. And then during my time in Saskatoon, I started to get a lot of calls from Calgary. I was offered a job by Ed Whalen at what became 2 and 7, and today is Global. Mm-hmm. I was offered a job by Ed Whalen there. I was offered a job at CFCN by Joe Hutton, who became Peter Lougheed's executive assistant. I was offered a number of jobs in Calgary, but they weren't a right fit. Mm-hmm. And then out of the blue comes my dream job from Montreal. And it was just such a thrill. And I thought, this is as good as it gets. And then came the opportunity to come out here and build something from the get-go. I don't know if you guys have seen the half-hour documentary Kevin Green did on me when I moved off the anchor desk at the end of 2013. Mm-hmm. It's still on. You can find it if you Google Daryl Jans, A Life in News. It's a half-hour documentary. Kevin did an amazing job of it. Went to Main Center on a brutal winter day to shoot the school that I went to as a kid. There was a picture of me in my class picture on the wall, and he shot that and so on. And so when I went back there in 2019, before they locked us up, I went to the school, which is now a museum, and wandered around there and thought, oh my goodness, this is so small. And I thought it was so big back then. It's so small. And I came through this. I graduated from Herbert High School in the metropolis of Herbert. And by the way, last summer, we had a group of us who live in Alberta had a 60th anniversary get together of our grad class. And we're doing it again this summer, but this time it's to celebrate our 80th birthdays.
Wow.
Most of us are turning and that are still alive. 15 of 35 are still alive.
Wow.
And we're getting together at the farm of one of our class members near Camrose and celebrating our 80th birthdays.
Wow, that's
because nearly all of us are turning 80 this year.
You know, under that Broadcast Hill building, we brought up some of the names. You worked with so many, again, legends: Ralph Klein, Russ Peak, Ken Nunes. We talked about Henry Viney, David Spence, and of course Barb Higgins.
Let's not forget Don Wood.
And Don Wood, another teacher of mine, absolutely. And Buckshot.
and he's going great. He is 88 years old, and his guitar from the Buckshot Show is now in a display, an online display from the National Music Center.
Wow. Let's talk a little bit about the time sitting at the anchor desk with Barb Higgins. You guys were there for, it was almost, what, 21 years?
21 and a half. In 1988, I went later in the year after Olympics and a few other things. I went to visit my mom in Swift Current, and the news she watched was Regina's, because Swift Current TV station was near the end of its run then, and was not a great news station. Anyway, she would watch Regina, and so we had stayed up kind of late, and we watched the late news, and this young, dark-haired woman was reading it, and I happened to get her name, and I came back and said to Dale O'Hara, our then news director, "Dale, there is a girl in Regina we've got to have." My co-anchor at that time was Michelle Hogan.
That's right.
whom I had taught at SAIT. But Michelle had got married and wanted to have babies. And so I knew we'd be losing her sooner or later. And I said to Dale, "This girl, you've got to have." And back then, you couldn't get TV from Regina. Dale drove to Medicine Hat, where they could get Regina, rented a motel room for a whole day, but only took it for an hour or so to watch Barb. And he came in the next morning or next day and said to me, "You're right. She's next on our list."
Yep.
And so when Michelle handed in her resignation, I went to Dale and said, "Now get me Barb Higgins." And he said, "I intend to." And he did. And we had the most incredible run. A consultant from Chicago, from Magid and Associates, said to us one time, he said, "You two," his meaning was, "You two are probably the best anchor duo in North America, maybe in the world."
Wow.
But he said, "It's because of the great chemistry between you." He said, "I work with anchor duos all the time. And most of the time, I'm in an ego battle because each one wants the spotlight and they can barely stand each other." He said, "It is so refreshing to work with a pair who genuinely like each other and want the best for each other." And Barb's a very emotional person. And she grabbed my hand and started tearing up a bit and said, "You got that right."
Mm-hmm.
She said, "We are friends." And we remain to this day.
Mm-hmm.
I can't wait for COVID to relax. And I can go and visit her and her husband on their beautiful place north of Cochrane. They have a beautiful acreage out there. And I can't wait to go see her again, because she's such a dear friend.
Yeah, it was such a wonderful, special relationship where you guys just, you know, complemented each other so well.
Mm-hmm.
And again, as a young teen, and then a person getting into broadcasting and watching it, and then getting a chance to work with both of you, it was just, like I said, it was so refreshing, because you guys were exactly on the air what you were in real life. Like you two could be sitting at a table at a restaurant and you'd be the exact same as you were when you were sitting behind the anchor desk. There was no false pretenses put on, type of thing.
I believe it was the last time we went for lunch before lockup came. We were at a nice restaurant for lunch, not far from Broadcast Hill. And people would come by and say, "This looks so right, seeing the two of you together again." And then Barb took a picture, or had our server take a picture of the two of us and at the table. And she posted that on Facebook. It got 6,500 hits.
Oh, yeah.
Hundreds of comments from people saying, "Oh, we miss you. This looks so good, seeing the two of you together again," and so on. It really was such an honor. I mean, here was a girl who grew up in the big city of Edmonton and was way younger, a whole generation younger than I.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, she was born, Barb had a great line. She said, "I was conceived in Winnipeg and grew up in Edmonton, or born in Edmonton, because her dad was with CN Rail and he got transferred from Winnipeg to Edmonton while her mother was pregnant with her. And so anyway, she grew up in the big city. I grew up in the little Mennonite community on a farm and slopped hogs and fed chickens and all that stuff. But that meant nothing. We just had such a connection between us and have to this day, such a great connection between us. And it's not something we knew it. I've got to go back and tell you. So after I had said to Dale O'Hara, get me Barb Higgins, and he said, I intend to. He came to me one day. I was sitting at my desk writing the 6 o'clock news. And he came to me and said, what are you doing Saturday? I said, I'm skiing. It was my first winter of skiing. I started skiing at the age of 47 after the Olympics. Wow. Because I was invited to come and give it a try at Lake Louise. And I did, and I got hooked. And so a young woman you remember who has since sadly passed on, Didja Bongers. Remember Didja?
Yep, I do.
She worked for us in the studio for a while. And she was from New Zealand. And Didja was the PR person for Nikiska. And so when Dale asked me, what are you doing Saturday? I said, it's media day at Nikiska, and I'm going skiing and having a great lunch. And he says, do you mind missing the lunch and coming and doing an audition? I said, only if it's with Barb Higgins. Otherwise, the answer is no. And it is. So I drove from, I had left a shirt and tie and jacket in the dressing room. And I drove back from the hill for lunch or during the lunchtime. I got into my shirt and tie and kept my ski pants on. And then I walked into the ladies' dressing room where John Cox, the great award-winning makeup artist,
right,
was doing Barb. And Barb's eyes and mine met in the mirror. She was facing the big mirror in the dressing room and the big lights on, of course, all around. So your face gets lit up from every angle. And she's sitting there and our eyes met in the mirror. And both of us instantly knew we were friends. And she didn't know what I looked like. She had never seen me. Mm-hmm. I had seen her. She had never seen me. She knew my name, but she didn't know what I looked like. And so, excuse me, I went in and said, hi, Barb, I'm Daryl. And she said, so nice to meet you. And as I say, a friendship was born right there. Mm-hmm. The chemistry was instant. When we were doing the audition read, the chemistry was there. We read for a little while, and then I said to her, Dale O'Hara had said to me, do some reads, we'll give you a script and you can do some reads, but when you feel comfortable with that, we know she's a good reader, but when you've had enough of that, just ask her anything you want, surprise her. And so after we'd read for a while, I put down my script and said, Barb, why this? Why news anchoring? Why not veterinary medicine or, medicine or whatever? And she looks at me kind of surprised. And then she giggled that giggle that Calgary came to love so much and said, well, when I was in college studying business, my mom went to a fundraiser and one of the silent auction items was a chance to do the late sports on CBC television.
Wow. And
she said, that night I got hooked. I didn't want sports. I wanted news, but I knew that's what I wanted. And so I switched at Nate from business to broadcasting, and the rest is history.
Wow, that's amazing. Josh, go ahead with one.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Ed Whalen, and you know him bringing you to Calgary and whatnot. What was it like working with Ed?
It was great. He, of course, was at a different station. We never worked together, but we did a fair number of telethons together,
right,
and other charity stuff, and it was so much fun working with him. But going way back, when I was a kid on the farm, I used to listen to Ed broadcast Saskatoon Quakers hockey games. He was the play-by-play man for the Saskatoon Quakers. And then he left for Alberta, and he was replaced by a guy named Don Whitman, who was from my home community. And Whitman, you recall, was a great broadcaster for CBC for many years. He did CFL football. He was great on curling and a number of other sports. So Ed goes back in my mind that far. And when he called me from Calgary in Saskatoon to ask if I wanted to follow his footsteps to Calgary, I told him, you know, this isn't the right time. I have a few other things in mind. And he was very gracious. Yeah. And then when I came to Calgary, he said, yeah, he said, you wouldn't come work for me. But Ed was terrific. He was a real people person. He was so genuine. Another guy who in a different way was like that, and it was that generation, I guess, was Henry Viney. Henry, I was still doing the 6 o'clock sports when I started. Mm-hmm. Not for long. And shortly after that Ken Newman's replaced him on there. And Henry then went to doing a nightly little sports editorial.
The way I see it.
The way I see it. Very
I
still good.
Remember that.
You pass. Yeah. And when I was a kid in Saskatchewan, there weren't a whole lot of radio stations, AM stations back then, and no FM yet. And so the Calgary stations, CFAC and CFCN, both came through clearly to where we were in Southwest Saskatchewan. And at Stampede time, both stations did their own chuckwagon race calling. Joe Carberry on CFAC and Henry Viney on CFCN. And I happened to like Henry's calling better than Joe's. So I would always listen to Henry, and his signature start to the race was, "There's the klaxon, and there they go." And when Henry did his final chuck wagon races in late 70s, I can't remember the exact year, I had the thrill of being in the booth in the eye in the sky with him when he called his final chuck wagon races. That was a real thrill for me, because as a kid in Saskatchewan, I just loved the way he called them. And, you know, I had so many favorite broadcasters for local, for Saskatchewan. There was a guy named Jim McLeod at CKCK in Regina, and a guy named Johnny Sanderson at CKCK, who became their well-loved, long-time television weatherman, and a guy named Don Slade, who eventually wound up in Calgary doing mornings at CHQR, then later also worked at CFAC radio. And I remember as a kid listening to Howard Langdale at CKRM in Regina, and then working with him here at CFCN in Calgary. On the broader scale, my early favorite, although I was so young, I didn't know really who he was, except I loved in the evening during the war, listening to the CBC National News with Lorne Green with my dad. Lorne Green, the voice of doom, as they called him, reading the war news on CBC. And then when he left to go to Hollywood and eventually become Pa Cartwright on Bonanza, the guy that replaced him, I loved his delivery. I loved his voice. A guy named Earl Cameron. And remember what was that show out of Edmonton with the hosers and all that stuff? Anyway, they had Earl Camembert.
SCTV?
SCTV.
Right.
Had Camembert and Floyd Robinson.
Yep.
Well, that was Earl Cameron and Floyd Robertson.
Yeah. Eugene Levy and, God, I can't remember who the other guy was.
John Candy was on there.
Yeah.
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 Too crazy. Wow.
Oh, it was a great show.
Josh, go ahead.
Oh, so obviously your career just spanned so long. Was there a favorite story, a memory that really sticks out to you?
The most memorable thing I ever did was in 1995 when Operation Christmas Child came to Canada. Samaritans First brought it here, and they had moved their headquarters to Calgary from Toronto. And when they started, Calgary and area, Southern Alberta, took to that shoebox program like no other place in the world. Not Britain, where it started, not the U.S., where they brought it with Samaritans First. Calgary took to it like no place. We filled, in 1995, we filled an Antonov 124, the biggest transport plane in the world, wow, with shoebox. And about October, who was our news director at that time? Murray Cunningham.
Murray Cunningham, yep.
Cunningham said to me, "You're going with Kevin Green with those shoeboxes to Bosnia and Croatia." I said, "Make me." No, I couldn't conceal my glee.
Yeah, but
I was so thrilled. And so we went over, we flew Canadian Airlines International to London, and then got ground transportation to the Stansted Air Base, which is now a commercial airport. Because of its long runways, it can handle the biggest planes in the world. And so five Antonov 124s came together there, and we then flew on one of those to Zagreb, Croatia. Three of them went to Zagreb because that was the real focus of the distribution of the shoeboxes that year, because it had been so, Bosnia and Croatia, mm-hmm, had been so devastated by the war over there for the past 4.5 years.
Yeah.
And so we went there and stayed in a comfortable, nice hotel in Zagreb. But every day we would go to bombed out schools and orphanages and so on in Bosnia with the shoeboxes. And there wasn't a day I didn't shed tears over what I saw. It was, and there wasn't a day, I don't think there was a single day in that whole week where I ate the lunch that the hotel had prepared for me. I would give it to some kid who didn't have any. And so did Kevin Green. So did other members of our distribution van. And our driver, get this, in the Graham family, every firstborn is called William Franklin Graham. And so there was Frank Graham, who had a son named Billy Graham, and Billy Graham had a son named Franklin Graham, and Franklin Graham has a son called Will Graham. And Will was about 20 years old at that time, and he was our driver. And he knew Bosnia like the back of his hand. He could take us anywhere that we wanted to go without even checking the map, because during the war, he had been doing distribution runs of aid to people all over Bosnia. And so anyway, but the long and short of it is, today, Will Graham, this young kid who was our driver, is the main preacher in the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association.
Wow.
He's probably more like Grandpa than anybody else has ever been. And he's such an unassuming, or at least as a young man was, and they tell me he's still like that. I haven't seen him in many years now. I saw him a few times after that when he'd come to Calgary because of his work with Samaritan's Purse. Right. But that whole trip stands out as the highlight of my career. For sheer fun, the two highlights are the trip to Baden-Baden for the IOC Congress and the victory of the Calgary Bid Committee, and the 1984 Summer Olympics in Los Angeles were the last Olympics before ours. And so therefore it was a news story. It wasn't just a sports story, it was a news story. So I got sent with a guy named Graham Bond as my shooter to cover that. So I was in TV through the best of years, mm-hmm. when TV made nothing but money. And if there was something big going on, you wanted your own person there, not some network guy that the local audience can't relate to.
Right. Well, Daryl, we've kept her for more than an hour. My apologies, but the stories are just so fantastic. We could go for another 24 hours. On behalf of so many people that were inspired by you as a teacher, by you as a media professional who aspire to be like you and to hopefully one day work with you, I can't thank you enough for what you did for my career, for what you did for all of their careers, and what you continue to do to inspire people. It's been just a pleasure to talk to you and catch up, and it's been way too long. When this is all over, let's find a restaurant, and nobody's going to take pictures of you and I.
But, best food in Alberta, right there on campus.
Yeah, absolutely. The Highwood, absolutely. As a matter of fact, mm-hmm. I have to go to campus later this afternoon. I'll pass right by there. But thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Great to work with you again, and great to meet you, Josh.
Awesome. Great to meet you too. And just thanks for being a voice of my childhood and being glued to watching you and Barb. You guys are absolute legends, and it was an honor to be able to connect and talk to you today. It was something off the bucket list to check off. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Enjoy the day, people.
Excellent. Thanks again, Daryl. This has been phenomenal. I'm going to have to reach out.